the icon. First of all, the music in the background has to do with establishing the arena or the atmosphere in which the icon is present. By icon, we really mean image. That's the general term, but we don't mean any image. We mean very specific kinds of image. And over a period of time, the definition of image has gotten more and more specific, or you might say more and more orthodox. Oh, Russian basis. The general image of an icon may be familiar to some of you. We just got back from conducting a tour, 42 of us, about half of us from Holden Village, went to Europe and the Middle East, and we went in search of icons. And we came back with some of them. Here's one. This will give you a look at what an icon tends to look like. There's a certain specific look about it. Now this is Russian, and this is 17th century. This is part of, as you can see, part of a larger group. It belongs in a set. In fact, it was on an iconostasis, a wall of icons. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But you know, this is Michael, of course. I bought this one back for son Michael, and you'll notice the gold. First of all, the background is gold. It's darker than it was originally. In its original condition, the gold was very brilliant. It's also very flat, and the way it's depicted is primarily with lines rather than the kind of painting we're used to seeing where it's shaded form and volume and perspective, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit, about why that is. You may just want to look close at those. Now that's Russian. Here's another one which we brought back for son Matthew. He's got to share it with Mark, Luke, and John, the Virgin Mary and the baby. Now this is Greek. This is a house icon. Michael's is a church icon. This is a house icon, and it's used in private devotions, and it's a complete thing all by itself. It isn't part of another thing. The painting is more it's faster and quicker, but the style of the icon is exactly the same. It's got the gold in the background. The figures are primarily frontal. People look at you rather than look away from you. You would never have in an icon a figure looking away from you unless that figure was historically and in every other which way damned. But icons, and that would be rare, icons are usually of the saints, of the blessed ones. And so they're looking straight at you. Let me start this and let them overlap. We've got a couple more. These are Tom's, and these are icon prints. And really, really neat. This is of course St. George, one of the really, really beautiful icons. This is a 15th century icon, and Matthew's icon is around the turn of this century, and you'll notice that the style is exactly the same. The history of icons begins around the 8th century. I mean of these kinds of images. I want to make a bigger definition for icon, but of these kinds of images, we're talking about the 8th century. And from that time until right now, where the process of painting icons is still very, very much being carried on, the style is exactly the same. Exactly the same. And the crazy thing about it is that even though the style is the same, there are individual icon painters whose names we know and whose style is very specifically their own. There are schools of icon painting, but the icon painter traditionally is a priest because this is sacramental. And the style is then handed down from father to son. And before you jump to some really nasty conclusions, in the Eastern Orthodox religion, priests are allowed to marry. Here's a smaller icon. Once again, the style, very much the same. Frontal, kind of mysterious looking because the way it's painted is not in a naturalistic way, at least according to our concepts of nature. And that's what I want to deal with. Then, just to bring it sort of up to date, on our tour, I did an icon, a three-panel icon, which in technical nomenclature is called a triptych, and I thought a triptych would be very appropriate for us, since we were on a trip, and so I did a literal triptych. This is the Virgin Mary. And down below is Joseph waiting for the bus. He was going to Egypt, and his airline tickets were written by El Al. And so they wouldn't let him fly. And so he had to take the bus. The reason why I did this, it's not funny. This is not funny. Our airline tickets to Cairo were written on LL blanks, and we were not allowed to fly to Cairo either. And so I figure if it's good enough for us, it's good enough for Joseph. And the center of the triptych has to be the crucifixion with Mary and John and our boat. That's our boat. The boat is because we were, as I was doing this, on our way to Patmos, the island of Patmos where John was in exile. And now, we certainly weren't in exile, but I thought we could womp up some sympathy for John, who, now that he is responsible for taking care of Mary, has wound up in a lot of trouble, an awful lot of trouble. And they sent him to Patmos, and we followed him there on the boat. And finally, last coming of Christ in judgment, and that's with an El Al airplane going across the bottom of it. If you've ever been to Jerusalem, you'll know that that's where the last judgment is going to take place. A whole lot of people are buried around, from all over the world, around the hillsides of that holy city, in expectations of judgment taking place right there on the Mount of Olives, because that's where he took off. So that's where he's going to land You know, it's only fair. And I don't mean to be irreverent. That's what an awful lot of people think. And of course, if you're buried right there, you know, you get a front row seat at the last coming, and with the outfits that they put Christ in on his throne of judgment, it would be worth getting up front to take a look at that. And I figured the best way to get to Jerusalem is by El Al. There are also a lot of other things mixed up in all of this iconography. Part of it is the labyrinth. I don't know how many of you have heard of the bull leapers and the labyrinth of Crete and the Minoan civilization, but one of the Greek gods was stuck in the labyrinth, this gigantic maze, and the lady of the court gave Theseus the golden thread so that he could follow it and find his way out of the maze. And so this is our labyrinth down here. All of the places, it's the map, all of the places that we went to on our tour. And the golden thread, which is not on here yet, will be wrapped around the finger of blessing of Christ on the throne of judgment. And that thread will not go to Cairo. Not even from the throne of judgment would they allow us to go to Cairo. And I tried. I even tried that, you know, all kinds of things about Arabs and Israeli peoples and stuff, but they wouldn't budge. So you may want to look at a relatively contemporary icon. The icon business is Eastern. First of all, you have to understand that we're talking about something which is Eastern. And it very well may be true that you know, East is East and West is West, and those two sides aren't going to get together. But whenever the West has gotten it into its head to work out some sort of iconness in its theology, the best it can do is wine and bread, and the rest of that, anything in addition, becomes very much suspect. You and I are children of an iconoclastic age. And although in the East they had tremendous, tremendous iconoclastic controversies, the people that painted the icons were put to death for quite a number of years. They had to do their painting in exile until finally the church decided and ordained icons as being relevant to worship. But it was terrible. Well, in the West, once we had the iconoclastic controversy settled, it seems that we just sort of let it go. We don't use an icon idea in our worship very much at all. I suppose the last great iconoclastic controversy in the West would have been the Reformation, where in the Peasants' War, following what Luther had to say about things, people threw rocks through stained glass windows and smashed the images and so forth. As children of iconoclasm, it's hard to understand the relationship that people have with image. The first thing we must understand is some kind of response, individual and corporate response to the created world. For the Eastern peoples, the whole created world is there primarily to show the presence of God. Everything, everything in the created world is there to show God's presence, God at work. Not just you and me, not just the priests, not just the stained glass windows, everything. In an interesting way, this is not only an Eastern Orthodox thing, this is essentially an attitude that is held in common by almost all primal religions as well. You'll find this in the tribes in Africa. You'll find this among the American Indians, those that still practice their old beliefs. That all the world, in every element, in rock, in stick, in sky, in some things more than others, like thunder, sun, that there you've got God's presence in a very dramatic and dynamic way, but in everything, in a rock. Now, once you understand that the whole created world is there as a way of exhibiting God's Spirit, then you have to understand that there are two kinds of realities. And you have to extend those two realities not just to people. When we talk about the two realities of people, we talk about what? Two things going on. Life and death? No, that's death is not quite a reality yet. We can anticipate it. We may look forward to it. But what am I standing here? What are you as you sit? Body and soul. Body and soul, or body and spirit. If I were then to depict the reality of you, paint your portrait, something of that sort, of you as icon, of you as God intended you when you were created, from the very beginning he had these intentions for you, that you should show forth his handiwork. So that when people look at you, they say, this is what God looks like in the world. Now, what is the look of that if I decide to paint you? The reality of you, then, has to be more than what you look like. Thank God. For some of us, that is the only redeeming feature we've got. That there is more than meets the eye. Praise God. Yeah. And so there is then the truth about us, which is also our redeemed, sanctified holiness. You can't, how do you get that? How do you get that in a painting if what the artist is primarily interested in is capturing your visibility? So the first rule of icon living and icon seeing is what you see is not what you get. It's not even half of what you get. For the early Christians, this was very important. For them, icons were not just paintings. This thing up there on your left, you see that? Don't look at the wall, which is really ghastly, that ishy cloud going up there. Ugh, is that dumb. But look at the floor. It's a bad linoleum job. There's really no way to build a church, right?
It's just
forgot to level it off. That's an icon. That thing sticking up through the floor is an icon. The early Christians had what is known as iconography or icon making out of place. Iconography of geological location. We tend to call it X marks the spot. But that's irreverence. They went to the places where Christ lived and worked and did miracles and had conversation, and they would build a thing over the top of it as though to honor it. But the place itself was the icon. This is the place where Christ says, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Now, it would be really kind of foolish for people to respect the place where all of this happened along the Sea of Galilee and go in there with a backhoe and rip up that rock. The one problem we have now is that there are people who are saying, that isn't really the rock. You know, the rock is actually 200 yards down the road. You know, follow me. I'll show you the real rock. You know. Well, they're in a process of doing that. They are actually doing their own icon smashing. You know, they're just smashing one another's rocks, and it's kind of bad news. But the point is, they referred to these rocks not just as icons. The word for these rocks, or for the Via Dolorosa, or for the church where St. Peter was in chains in Rome, or for the house where Mary died in Ephesus, or all of these locations, they referred to them not just as icons, they referred to them as martyrs. Martyrs. Now, we've always thought of martyrs as people who have died, you know, for their faith, but that isn't what martyr means. Martyr means witness. Witness. And therefore, the place is the last remaining witness of the actions of God on this earth. That rock was there. And therefore we honor it. And it honors us. It instructs us. It shows us in its very presence that God had a job to do here in our midst. Okay. From the found object, then, I think it's not too difficult a leap to take in the whole theology of the Incarnation, that is, Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. The whole first gospel, the first chapter of the Gospel of John is icon. It's icon language. Word, that is, will of God, is now put into flesh form and dwells among us. For many Eastern Orthodox theologians, even if man had not sinned, God would have had to come into the earth and be born and take on flesh form, so that he could demonstrate the full participation, even as his created people, in his creation. That's kind of an exciting thought, because in the West, our idea of God coming down to be born in a manger is really to redeem all of this, to redeem us who are now lost, and then to bring us back and all of creation back with us. For the Eastern people, creation is not that far away from God. There is a goodness in all of creation. There is essential goodness in us. I don't want to go into the theology of Adam. It's kind of unique. But for Eastern theologians, the fall is not that big a deal. For the West, of course, by one man sin entered into the world and death by sin. But for the East, God is constantly in all of this stuff that he puts around, in all of the stuff that he gives us, in one another, in ourselves, is calling us back to himself. That means we got to, you know, have our eyes open and look out for it. If Word was made flesh, that means that flesh is now important. Flesh is not something you sneeze at. Matter matters. If God works out our salvation in water and bread and wine, then obviously the things of this earth can hold the Spirit of God as we hold the Spirit of God. Christ says, I have come to glorify the Father. That is, I have come to make God visible. Now, as I glorify the Father, even so you also now are to glorify God in me. That means we are to be God visible. That's our other reality. That's the truth of us. Material things, then, have two lives. The visible, tangible life, and the life which is what God intends them to be, that is signs, symbols even, not just signs, but also symbols. A sign points, like this way to the men's room or whatever. It points and says the action is over there. A symbol takes place in what it is pointing to. So Christ is symbol, and that is not to make him less by calling him that. He doesn't just point to God the Father over there, but he says, no man cometh to the Father but by me. Therefore, I take part in the action to which I am addressing myself. The world of symbol is also the world of our intervening with them. So that if God is talking about the means of grace, like I love the use of wine and bread, it isn't just simply, the sacramental elements are not just simply grapes and wheat, as God created grapes and wheat, but they are transformed by us. We not only got to pick grapes, we got to stomp them with our feet. We got to mash them. We not only have to pick wheat, we got to grind it. We got to pound it and roll it and cook it in fire. So all of this creation then kind of groaneth together. And the end result is how God addresses himself to us. What we see in the sacrament, which is bread and which is wine, is not what we are getting. What we are getting is the body and blood of Christ. How do we know? Because it's promised. It is promised. What about all this other stuff? How about paintings? Did he promise all that stuff in paintings? As an artist, I'd like to think he did. But let's take the Old Testament as the idea of anti-image. Those poor Hebrew people who couldn't have pictures of God because no man hath seen God and lived. Now comes the Christ in flesh. And now lots of people have seen God and lived and have gone other places to tell about it. Now, if God takes on the form of flesh, then his visibility is actually interpreted by the Orthodox people as a call, an actual assignment to make his image and to make images of all of the saints as models for us, as people who reflect the glory of God. The style in which that is done has of necessity to be very abstract, huh? In the Eastern tradition, you've got a style which is inverse perspective. It's reverse. It's not at all like we're accustomed to. Everything opens up as it goes away from us. Instead, it comes together. Thrones that people sit on are at, can you see it down below here? There's a good example of it, in fact. See the little pedestal for the throne? Now, in the Western tradition, that pedestal would actually get smaller and smaller as it goes away from us. We know that to be the visual truth. The road as it goes down Holden and heads toward the ballpark is coming together, getting smaller, and finally it meets. The two sides join. So that's the truth. Except that isn't the truth, is it? I mean, any of you that have walked down to the ballpark know that that isn't the truth. The road does not come together. In fact, it just goes on and on and on, you know, blah. And it goes on and on the other way, too, until it falls into the lake. No, roads don't come together. So what you see and what you know are not the same truth. Which is true? Yes.
what you see and what you know are not the same truth.
Which is true? Yes. Both. Even though they cannot exist together in rational thinking. But now come the Eastern people, and there's a whole other thing. Things are getting farther and farther apart. And you say, well, that doesn't look like any road I ever saw. But now you understand about your world. What is it about the created world that makes you believe that things are all coming together after they leave you? That's not a worldview. From you, everything kind of opens up. Gets larger, larger, larger until it surrounds you. It goes all the way around your back. That's the truth. And you can consider yourself to be like the hub in a wheel. And that all the created universe is all the way out past that rim. And the spokes get farther and farther apart as they go away from you. And that's a completely different worldview. And it's also the truth. It's what you know about the world. So, you've got an Eastern concept about worldview that says, this is the way it is. Now, if I sit down to paint, and this is going to be hard, as a priest painter of icons, I will now try very hard to eliminate those aspects of visual truth in favor of a combination of what is seen and what is known. And when they contradict one another, what is known will prevail. I will paint all of the saints in the truth of their transfiguration. For the Greek Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox people, the transfiguration and the resurrection are the two great moments in the life of Christ. Not that they were sort of non-crucifixion people, I mean. They weren't. They reveled in the crucifixion. Because why? Because it was God dying. They reveled in the incarnation story because it was God being made man. In the West, it's God being made man. In the East, it's God being made man. So that when we look at man, we see God. Athanasius says, and God became man so that man might become God. That's a little scary. That's just a little scary. We've even got the Athanasian Creed written by the guy what said that in our hymn books. Of course, we never read it, but it's in there anyway. So we are to look like God.
We have as his creatures all of that potential, and if I am to paint us as icons, I am going to have to paint that transfigured potential. As Epiphanos, in light, as vision, tending to be flat, tending to be totally representational, but as symbol rather than as full-blooded form. Now the problem, and it is really a problem. If now I paint the truth about you as saint, not just what you look like, but what you are as a representative of God, the whole of you, then what I have painted is not a picture of you. Hang on, folks. It's you. It is you. It is more you than a photograph of you. So many people in the East are scared to have their pictures taken. You people who have traveled have known that, I think, have experienced sticking your camera into the face of somebody in the Eastern world and having them, you know, gesture you away. A lot of us that used to think that that was because if we got your picture on film, we had part of you. You know, we owned you. We had, you know, we could stick little needles in you after we got home. Not at all. Not at all. It's that if I take a picture of you, that isn't the truth. I've only got you in your carnal state. I haven't got you in the whole truth of you, which is the transfigured you, which is the resurrected you. You've already been resurrected, you realize. As baptized people, you have been buried with Christ by baptism unto death, and raised again, not to the same old stuff, but to new life, to new transfigured life. I don't mean after you die because you've died. I mean now. How many of you people realize you're in heaven? And I don't mean just because you're at Holden. I mean you're in heaven wherever you go with your baptized body. It's a guarantee. That makes you an icon. And so, when we pray, oh, and of course Mary, Mary is so important. And they had to right away make Mary the mother of God, huh? Why? Not so that Mary could become the fourth member of the Trinity, but so that they knew for sure, so that they acknowledged for sure that Christ was true God. And if Christ is true God, then Mary is, of course, mother of God. Once again, as Lutherans, we have such a hard time. I think we have much more of a difficult time than Luther did, who went sort of crazy about Mary. Oh, he got so sweet and lovey-dovey about Mary. If you want to get kicked out of the Lutheran church these days, read Luther's sermon about the Virgin Mary. Yeah, it's very Roman Catholic. Yeah. So So Mary then is the mother not just of the incarnation idea, but of the whole idea of us as being icons. If Christ is not God, then, you know, we don't have to worry about us representing God. It's not going to make it. But we confess it. And if in the sacrament we can acknowledge that fish food is the body of Christ and manischewitz is the blood, then in the sacramental life of the Orthodox religion we can also acknowledge this is Mary, not in her natural self, but in her person self. Just as fish food is not the same components of Christ's body, blood does not course through his veins in the form of wine, but it is in his natural self that we say, you know, division. It is in his essence self, in his person self, that we say the two are one thing. Whatever Mary is now is in the icon. Whatever Christ is in the icon, which is now you, Christian. It is now you. So we can look at the whole world, you know, as representative of the God who made us all. We are not honoring statues then. We are not laying homage to wood and stone, because this is not a picture of the Virgin Mary. It is. This is not a picture of Christ. It is. Oh, isn't that hard? Pretty soon whole buildings become heaven. The liturgy is practice for what we do in heaven. The paintings we paint are practice for the saints we will meet in heaven and who we are meeting here. The emperor and the empress are Christ's. You see the halo around Justinian? The shield bearer is carrying Justinian's monogram, the Cairo of Christ. And if you'd count the people in his retinue, you would see that there are 12. Everything around us then speaks of who we are as sanctified people. Eventually this changes, so that at the time of the Renaissance, the world as transfigured world becomes less important. The world as visible world, where truth is now solely in the eye, takes over, and man becomes the measure of all things. That man as measure of all things is what we have become heir to. That's where we started. I am suggesting this morning that we might begin a little before then, maybe all the way back to the first chapter of the Gospel of John. Have a good day.